looking at a lot of different things. We're looking at a lot of different bills, ideas, concepts. It's been going on for a long while. Background checks. I will say that for the most part, sadly, if you look at the last four or five, going back even 5 or 6 or 7 years, for the most part, as strong as you make your background checks, they would not have stopped any of it. So it's a big problem. It's a mental problem. It's a big problem.
On Friday afternoons, we here at the recent podcast Editors Roundtable send out a preliminary list of possible topics to be discussed during our Monday morning taping. These can be pretty damn speculative before a long holiday weekend, given the current pace of the news cycle. Lately, and depressingly, it seems as often as not that by the time we reconvene, there's been another mass shooting. This time it was in Odessa, Texas, where a 36-year-old man was stopped by cops after being fired from his job on Saturday, got into a shootout at a traffic stop, then fled, opened fire on basically whoever crossed his path, killing 7 people, injuring 22, before himself being gunned down by police. Meanwhile, just to keep the mood as grim as possible here on Tuesday, Hurricane Dorian, as we speak, is just parked over the Bahamas right now, wreaking devastation while Florida prepares for the very worst. Hi, everyone. Matt Welch here, joined by my colleagues Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mengu Ward. Good morning, folks.
Howdy.
Hey, Matt.
Hi.
So, Catherine, after the last mass shooting event in El Paso, Texas, the anti-immigrant mass shooting, the president started or kind of kickstarted some bipartisan negotiations on a possible gun control deal. Over this weekend, we heard from, and Elizabeth Nolan Brown has already written about, Mike Pence, I think, floating that part of that might involve some kind of expedited death penalty action. At the same time, that clip that we just listened to, the president reminded people that most of the kind of most talked about measures that are contemplated after these events wouldn't have retroactively kind of done much of anything. So what is your sense, Catherine, as the guardian of the Second Amendment in American politics, what is your sense of where Trump is and is likely to go, given that he, unlike Mitch McConnell, for example, appears to be kind of driving these discussions and negotiations?
I have no sense of where Donald Trump is likely to go. I have no idea what is going to happen. Right, he's been alluding to this package that's working its way through Congress or something. It may or may not contain anything having to do with background checks. It may or may not contain other forms of gun control. It's super unclear to me, and I'm paying attention. So I can't imagine what the rest of the American public thinks is going on right now. The detail, though, which you alluded to and which Liz Nolan Brown covered this morning about the possibility that we would expedite executions of convicted mass murderers strikes me as the most wrong thing we could do here. Expediting executions is not a good idea. This is a very, very small number of cases getting executed faster, which will still not mean getting executed quickly, to be clear, and thereby implying that we will somehow remove some of the layers of legal protections accorded to the accused and the convicted is not a good idea. It is not healthy. It does not actually result in fewer mass shootings in any mechanism that I can envision, and it almost certainly will abbreviate due process in ways that other people will suffer for, not just mass shooters.
It also comes on the heels of a recent execution in Texas where an innocent man was put to death. So, the death penalty, that's not going to go anywhere, but it Trump's reaching for that, I think, foregrounds the fact that we're talking about symbolic action here. He, in the past, he did push for a bump stock ban or enacted one through executive action. He's not averse to gun control legislation that has seen any gun control legislation on the part of Republicans is seen as tantamount to shredding the Second Amendment, and they're against it. But Trump has shown some willingness to do stuff. It turns out from early reports that the shooter here, that he was turned down for based on a background check already. He did not pass the existing limits in Texas for a background check. So it's not clear what would have prevented him. And I think that gets to, You know, the first question with mass shootings is, what is the kind of symbolic action that is going to be put into place? And Trump now is signaling to his supporters that he is going to back away from any kind of gun control legislation because they want that, unless it's something completely ridiculous and useless, like expediting, you know, executions, you know, capital punishment, which will have no effect on anything. But by the same token, the other question, and I think the more substantive one, is whether or not we actually are in the midst of an uptick of mass shootings. And after Dayton and El Paso, I talked to James Allen Fox for the Reason podcast, who's the preeminent criminologist who's been studying this stuff since the early 80s. And he points out two things. One is that based on current trends, there's no reason, or current events, there's no reason to believe that we're in a massive uptick of mass shootings or of mass killings. And it's important to get those distinctions right, so that anything we do may or may not have any effect on what happens, because we're talking about something, you know, a series of events that are not in fact growing. They're such rare events, it becomes very difficult to act with any kind of meaning and effectiveness on reducing the number of deaths in mass shootings, because they are such rare events.
Peter, isn't that all, though, at the same time, kind of, you know, That's Dr. Spock, not Dr. Spock, but actually, what's his name?
Mr. Spock. Yeah.
Sorry, gosh.
Yeah.
Been a long time.
Dr. Spock, I think, wants pediatricians to ask about whether there
Dr.
are guns
Spock
in the
was,
home. So he's actually the opposite.
He was big on gun control. Yeah, actually, yeah. Dr. Yeah. Benjamin Spock, also against the Vietnam War.
Whereas Mr. Spock frequently used a disarming Vulcan neck pinch instead of a phaser.
That's right. Yeah. And he always set his phaser to stun, right? Not to kill.
I don't know if it was always.
I feel so. Like...
And he did try to kill Kirk in that one episode.
He
where
was
they
driven
were
mad.
To Pring.
Yeah, he was driven mad by urges.
Matt, were you just channeling the Washington Post profile
Absolutely.
Of Justin Amash there? Because I think we should note that there is a pretty good Washington Post profile of Justin Amash that came out this morning, and it includes a quote from him telling a woman who had lost friends in the 2007 Virginia Tech mass shooting, you don't need to be scared of this stuff. Statistically speaking, it's not common. Also noting that Justin Amash's eyebrows are sort of pointy in that same graph.
Yes, and he was wearing, when I saw him that same week, we went out to dinner, and he was wearing a T-shirt that Peter will certainly know, and probably the other two of you as well. But it's a reference to a famous episode of The Second Generation, or someone.
The Second Generation, Matt.
Whatever.
The
Next
or
Generation.
The Next Generation.
The Beat okay. Generation poet turned assassin. No, and mm-hmm. he had to go at great lengths to try to culture explain to me what any of it meant. And I just was, it was as useless as the Lizzo conversation that we had just before.
Was it about being assimilated, Matt?
It had to do with like a someone who only speaks in literary allusions. Hmm. Peter, is that ringing off your Spock dar, your Peter tingle?
Please stop. I'm begging you. I'm begging you to never say, is that ringing off your Peter tingle ever again?
I feel okay, like I'm in an accent. Yeah. Peter, what were you going to say? What were you going to say
control.
About...
We're going to say about my question. We always go to the, well, actually, mass shootings are not all that common, yet the body counts are getting higher. There's no question, but the body counts are getting higher. Terrorism wasn't all that common back when leftoids were hijacking planes in the early 1970s. But
we overreacted to terrorism in the wake of 9/11, Matt, to the enduring detriment of our civil liberties and our basic freedoms and culture. So
sure,
I think it is actually, you know, I hate actually has been kind of canceled as a word, but it's important to figure out what the social reality is, because otherwise we're going to implement policies that are addressing kind of phantom fears or things that are not important. So
right,
but, and your point is taken.
But body counts are getting higher on the individual events.
Yes,
clearly over the last 5 years. So Peter, let's go to a policy question, which is Kamala Harris and Beto O'Rourke are out there saying we need mandatory buybacks. What is the logistical problem with that notion?
So let's start by actually just talking about the politics of this. They're saying it because mandatory buybacks poll increasingly well. And if you look at the Quinnipiac poll recently, it polled the question of mandatory gun buybacks. So that's when you have to sell your weapon that meets some certain criteria. Maybe not all weapons, but weapons that meet some certain criteria, perhaps the same criteria that defined assault weapons, kind of nonsense criteria that didn't actually matter in terms of gun power and that sort of thing, but they would be required then to sell it back to the government, and they would pay you for it. We've seen gun buyback programs before in other countries, particularly in Australia. That was one that President Obama liked to cite and has gotten some attention from liberals who have argued that it was relatively successful. I think the Australia model, what happened in Australia, just isn't really applicable in the United States. It's not clear that it was a success on its own terms in terms of reducing shootings and murders and suicides, which is the argument that it did. The trajectory was already going down for murders and suicides. And the other thing about the Australia program is that they started from a much lower baseline in terms of gun ownership, and they were still only able to buy back about a third of the weapons that they were trying to get. And so if you think of the United States, where there are several hundred million guns in circulation, perhaps as many as 400 million guns, and you manage to buy back a third of them, so let's say it is as successful as Australia, you still have 250 million or so guns in private hands in the United States. And so just in terms of you, and that still leaves you with a country that just has a much higher prevalence of gun ownership, a much higher number of guns in private hands than any other country. And so if you think the problem, if this is the argument that you want to make from the left, it's not the libertarian argument, to be clear, but if liberals want to argue that the problem is very high rates of gun ownership, therefore, we should do what Australia did, you're still going to be left with very high rates of gun ownership. And there's not really a sort of clear answer about how to get to the other side of the liberal argument here without changing the Second Amendment. And if that's what liberals want to do, then that's what they should be proposing. And that's the conversation, to use another canceled word, that's the conversation we should be having. But it's not the conversation we're having. We're talking about red flag laws that would basically attempt to do pre-crime. We're talking about using algorithms to try and sort of figure out, you know, who's going to be doing what in advance that would at best be probably ineffective, and at worst quite likely would target people who have done nothing wrong. We're talking about background checks that in this case, in the case of the Texas shooter, he failed a background check. The background check stopped him from buying a weapon, as far as I can tell. And so it's just very difficult to sort of work through the policy solutions, regardless of your priors, even if you believe that guns are the problem. And to be clear, I'm not saying they are, but even if you start there, what do you do? And what is your, and the answer is that you often get in response is, well, you can't just do nothing. And if you look at that New York Post editorial that called for the reinstatement of the assault weapons ban, they kind of have this sentence in there that's like, well, it's not clear that the assault weapons ban did anything. It's really unclear whether it was effective. And in fact, it is unclear whether it's effective. There's not great evidence that it was effective at stopping murders. It's really, I think, a problem. On the other hand, I think it's also a little bit of a problem for gun rights supporters and for libertarians, because the more attention these things get, the more often they happen and the more deadly they are, the more public support is going to be built for doing something, regardless of whether it works and regardless of whether there's good evidence that this is going to be an effective tool for stopping mass shootings, murders, and suicides. And that's why you see increasing support for programs like a mandatory gun buyback.
Yeah, just in my previously appointed role as a defender of the Second Amendment, just want to be clear, like, mandatory buyback is a shitty euphemism. It's confiscation. That's what it is. And I think, you know, in the same way that we, broadly speaking, oppose indiscriminate application of eminent domain, I would actually go so far as to oppose all eminent domain, even though there's a constitutional justification for it. Like, The phrase buyback in most people's minds sounds like this thing that they've seen on their local news where the police department runs a little program and somebody brings in their grandpa's gun that they don't need anymore and everyone gets $20 and a pat on the head. That is not what a federal mandatory buyback would look like. It would look like the dark, dark picture painted in Austin Bragg's very, very funny video, How to Have a Gun-Free America in Five Steps, which is violence and armed standoffs and many more gun deaths than we currently are experiencing.
So Catherine, I want to, just in the interests of responding to the arguments that get made here, when I see discussion of gun buybacks, and the argument comes up that, well, if you really tried to pursue that policy in an aggressive way, you would end up with the federal government in a lot of shootouts with heavily armed people. The liberal argument is that reflects very badly on gun owners.
I disagree. Like, I think The argument that it reflects badly on gun owners, first of all, many gun owners would peaceably give their guns over, right? Just as people bow to eminent domain all the time, just as people bow to government condemning their property, doesn't mean it's, so there would be a few people who would indeed get an armed standoff. It would reflect badly on those people if those confrontations end in death. At the same time, we do not say it reflects badly on people when they are defending their rights, even when they take up arms to do so. And I really take exception with the idea that if the federal government shows up, points a bunch of guns at someone, and they turn and point their gun back, that that person is the one who has somehow initiated the harm.
Again, this goes to the Spock, versus Kirk argument or something. Catherine, you may be right that logically that all makes sense. But if, for instance, and this is not going to happen, but if Congress passes a law saying that certain classes of guns are banned, and that people who believe in the rule of law, which is what, gun owners always talk about, refuse to give up those guns, and they're given plenty of time and warning and everything, and they're told where to bring their guns or whatever. And then you have a bunch of Clive and Bundy family standoffs in various places. It's not going to reflect well on the federal government, but it's going to reflect really badly on gun culture and on places like the NRA, where the NRA now is arguing against itself from 15, 20, 30 years ago. It's arguing against Ronald Reagan, who passed a bunch of gun control restrictions in the wake of his being shot. There's an unreality about the gun control argument, because it is like we're always talking about it as if the terms of the debate in any given moment are what they have been for the past 400 years or 250 years or 200 years. And that's just not true. The NRA and gun rights activists have gotten more and more extreme in what they claim is a legitimate right that cannot be entailed by the government. And the Second Amendment is not the same as the First Amendment. It's not a Congress shall make no law. Very few people within the NRA or within the gun rights community are seriously pushing for the idea of mass ownership of machine guns, which are effectively banned from most private use. So I think you're just wrong as a statement of projected fact if these standoffs happen. None of this is going to happen, though, because this will disappear in a couple of weeks, and there is a copycat effect of mass shootings tend to go in kind of cycles, and then they fade for a while. And we'll forget about this because all of this is taking place against a backdrop of massive and persistent decline in gun-related violence in America. And the fact of the matter is the things that have helped to see that decline happen and continue have nothing to do with mass shooters or with mass killers, especially. They're a breed apart. They're few and far between. It's impossible to pick them out based on, a couple of characteristics. And it's something like terrorism or some level of street crime that we are going to have to deal with and live with. And it's a horrible thing to say to people who are grieving, but there really is not a clear public policy fix on this. And the one thing that we can say is a lot fewer people die because of gunshots than they did 30 years ago or 20 years ago. And that's a good thing.
I agree with you that it's as a matter of prediction, it is not likely that this is how it ends. All of the scenarios in which, gun owners are facing off with the federal government are hypotheticals in which the federal government acts. But at the same time, there are real effects to a constant vague threat of that action. And, you know, the most benign form of it is the giant uptick in gun sales under Barack Obama every time
who
he
did,
you know,
absolutely nothing. To,
who did exactly
nothing
did
against guns?
And
so
yet,
no, but I mean,
if
so,
our goal is to overall reduce the burden of gun violence, and that includes not just mass shootings, but also suicides, also gang-related violence, also domestic violence, creating a climate where people who like to own guns feel vaguely threatened and therefore buy more guns is deeply counterproductive.
The people who engendered that under Obama was the NRA, and it was gun rights supporters, because Obama, the only thing he did in his first term about gun rights was to open up the ability for people to carry guns into national parks and on Amtrak. He actually didn't
do anything. I agree that Obama was not a gun controller, but his rhetoric...
it's not his rhetoric. It was the rhetoric of gun rights owners who said Obama is coming to take your weapons. He made no moves towards that.
But Obama also said Obama is coming to take your weapons.
You're telling me that the NRA does not have a particularly large outsized effect, and they are always telling you that if anybody doesn't.
Okay. One way or the other about the NRA's role. I agree that they, of course, have polarizing rhetoric, but they don't have the power to control this, whereas presidents have the
power to say, they're coming for your guns, buy more guns. And all I'm saying, I'm not disagreeing with you. I agree that if you make it look like something is going to be taken away, people are going to buy. You know, it's like before Prohibition, you know, I'm sure everybody bought as much booze as they possibly could. And all I'm saying is that the NRA, which is one of the most literally and figuratively corrupt organizations and not even particularly consistent on defending gun rights or Second Amendment rights. They were kind of crappy on all of the recent Supreme Court cases that led to expansions of gun rights, you know, because it didn't fit with their particular political agenda. The NRA, which is currently, you know, imploding because of corruption, was one of the motive forces in making people freak out about the idea that guns were going to be taken away under Obama.
So can I add just we've talked a bunch about the insufficiency of public policy responses. But Nick, you said something about the copycat effect that I just want to jump on a little bit here, which is that I think the copycat effect is real. And I think that it is driven heavily, not entirely, but heavily by media coverage. And so to me, there is a non-public policy response that might make a real difference, which is that I think news organizations should resist covering these things wall to wall, should resist giving them the kind of attention that they get. And that's very difficult because a mass shooting is legitimate news. The public has a right to know, and there should not be any sort of law restricting the ability of news organizations to cover these as much or as little as they want. But in the same way that news organizations have internal ethics rules around, say, not revealing the names of rape victims, news organizations can exercise restraint, and they can cover these things in ways that are not as defined by a kind of drive-by, a kind of gawking spectacle, where they just sort of point their cameras and point their coverage at these events over and over and over and over again, and they dominate the front pages, they dominate cable news, and that creates, I think, the literature on this is I think pretty convincing. If you look at the academic research, that creates an incentive for nihilistic, often suicidal individuals to try and go get their name in the headlines the same way. And so that, I think, is something that could be done. It's not a thing that Congress can do. It's not a thing that President Trump could do. But pointing to this research, pointing to its conclusions and saying, look, if you are a member of the press, if you are, whether you're a pundit or whether you're a reporter and you are making coverage decisions, this is the sort of thing that you can talk about less and you can make less of an issue. Sure, I think there will also sort of be that then creates it does create opportunities for kind of black market discussions on Reddit or 8chan or whatever. I'm not saying that it would go away. It's impossible to suppress the details of these events completely, and we would have to deal with that. But major news organizations making a giant deal out of every single one of these, I think, events has, I think, contributed to the lure of these for the disturbed individuals who commit them.
it wouldn't just create, black market discussion. It would create entire branches of new media. And one analog here is that after World War II, there was a big meeting in Chicago, I believe. There was a commission called the Robert Maynard Hutchins Commission, I think. And it was where everyone got together, news executives, and said, you know what? We've got to figure out how to de-tabloidize newspapers going forward. There was a feeling that under William Randolph Hearst and other publishers of tabloids that there had been too much coverage of crime, scandal, and these types of things. And also that it made the country weak and less likely, because Hearst was a big America First guy at the beginning of the war, that made a company, country more weak in the face of external threats. And so it, at the same time that there was a big kind of standardization and death of newspapers and consolidation, that's the word I'm wanting for, everywhere, there was this feeling of like covering crime is definitionally exploitive and it leads to all this whipped up fear and everything else like that. And that was by far the biggest ethos of that. And what does that do? That helps kind of create the rise of talk radio, the internet culture, internet webzines, and things like that. You see it right now in Europe. There's largely a taboo in respectable journalism to talk about terrorist violence, any kind of like immigration related issues. And so it drives it all, both in terms of the rise of political parties on the far right, but this kind of a media discussion, it just has unintended consequences as well that are worth thinking about. And yeah, I still want to talk about whatever the hell I want to talk about, Peter Suderman. But now I'm going to talk about something else. I just wanted to say, Nick had mentioned Reagan being in favor of gun control after being shot. What I recall from history is more that as governor of California, after the Black Panthers marched on Sacramento wearing their weapons, suddenly Governor Reagan said, maybe, and the NRA too backed it, that maybe we need to have more common sense gun control restrictions then. So that's a famous thing. And we've written about it in our archives, and I encourage people to go check that out. But I want to switch gears to Afghanistan, another place where there's guns, I hear. Yesterday, the United States special envoy to Afghanistan told the country's leaders there that according to the terms of an agreement that is currently being hashed out with the Taliban, the evil Taliban, America would withdraw 5,400 troops from our longest ever war within 135 days, 4 months, with a full withdrawal of our current level of 14,000 troops. Pondered, they're not really sure when, maybe 16 months from now. Here's a quote from the envoy, as reported by the New York Times, but it is not final until the president of the United States also agrees to it, unquote. Apparently, the president is feeling a bit tetchy about the exact timeline. Catherine, how worried are you or anxious are you right now about the parking lot golf club battles between Rand Paul and Lindsey Graham?
Wow, that was a pivot on the question there.
This is what we do with you.
It's fine. Right. I mean, that caveat is a real caveat. Like, we're going to definitely withdraw from Afghanistan as soon as the president has a consistent view about whether we should withdraw from Afghanistan. So never. I would love to see this war end it.
We're definitely going to pass some sort of gun control or gun measure.
As soon as the president has a consistent view on gun control. So never.
But also possibly tomorrow.
But maybe tomorrow, but probably never. I would like to see this war ended, as has been noted in a lot of the coverage today of this potential plan. It is America's longest war, unless you count the war on drugs. And it's high time that we get the hell out. At the same time, I am hard pressed to imagine that this promise of withdrawal, like so many promises of withdrawal, should be trusted.
Get your minds out of the gutter. Nick, there's violence is on the rise right now. Even as these talks are going on, there's a huge truck bomb over the weekend that killed a bunch of people. The very places where either America is pulling out or contemplating pulling out, the Taliban is engaging in kind of these violence. How do you, intervention skeptic, respond to the perennial charge by a lot of, kind of centrist Washington and the generals saying, we pull out, it's going to be Cambodia 2.0.
Yeah, it's not going to be Cambodia, but it will probably be Vietnam, and it's going to be ugly. We can do, the best possible to do an orderly withdrawal that also has some guarantees from the Taliban and other people that are still there, interests that are still in Afghanistan. But, you know, it was a mistake to be there this long, and it's going to be ugly when America pulls out, as it is in almost every instance where that kind of thing happens. And that doesn't mean that it shouldn't happen. It should happen as quickly and as definitively as possible. And then we should go about trying to figure, you know, actually working to create a foreign policy that is predicated more upon diplomacy and trade and possible, military alliances and intervention. But, you know, we have to reset the table. And it's not good enough to say we are, you know, still bleeding, but we can keep the bleeding to, you know, a slow enough motion where it doesn't completely destroy Afghanistan and it doesn't completely destroy America, and we'll just keep it going forever and ever. That really should not be an option, and it won't be.
Suderman, you swim like a happy otter beating sea anemones with rocks in Elizabeth Warren's white papers. What can you tell us? Yeah.
Why?
Yeah. What can you tell us about how President Warren's Afghanistan policy or, you know, related foreign policy differs from President Trump's or anybody else's?
Yeah, actually, I want to just compare her just before we get to Elizabeth Warren. Let's compare her to a couple of other leading candidates. So a couple of months ago, the New York Times did this great survey package in which they asked a whole bunch of questions of all the leading contenders except Joe Biden, asked them the exact same question, caught them on video, and then printed and published their answers. And one of the questions was, would there be American troops in Afghanistan at the end of your first term? Kamala Harris's answer is, we need to have a presence there in terms of supporting what the leaders of Afghanistan want to do. So yes, basically, right? Bernie Sanders' answer is a little shorter, and you can imagine, Matt, I'm going to let you do the impression if you want. It's I suspect not. So, it's a completely non-committal answer. Everybody else is just sort of like, well, we don't know, or, you know, there's bad guys there, which means we need to be there. And then Elizabeth Warren gives a one-word answer. No.
No.
No. Just no. That's it. No. Next question. Not no with a qualifier. No. There would not be American troops in Afghanistan at the end of her first term. It is actually a pretty clear and consistent commitment from her, at least for this year. There were, at least in terms of the last year, I mean, starting at least last fall and then through early 2019, she has been talking about how we just absolutely need to get our troops out of Afghanistan. And this is something that she's been really quite firm on. And it goes to kind of her big theme, her kind of populist message, in which she really is focused on the economic and household lives of the middle and lower middle class. And that's who is over there. That's who makes up a lot of the kind of deployed troop ranks. And so that's her base. That's her constituency. It's also, in a lot of ways, Donald Trump's base and a lot of Donald Trump's constituency. And I don't think that even beyond their kind of ideological commitments and their instincts, I don't think it is an accident that both of them basically end up agreeing with each other in terms of we should be, to the extent that Trump has a position, it has tended to be, we should not be in Afghanistan. That has not been practically the case, but he's talked about that. He campaigned on that. And of course, we should remember, Trump campaigned on we shouldn't be involved in all these foreign wars, and we are still over there. So Elizabeth Warren's promises to get the troops out of Afghanistan would not necessarily turn into practical reality. As Trump has discovered, it's very difficult to find advisors and people sort of in the world of the State Department and the military who want to enact withdrawal strategies.
I would point out that when we were all in Freedom Fest in Las Vegas, the annual libertarian / conservative conference that we participate in, Mike Lee was on stage, a senator from Utah, along with Justin Amash and Thomas Massie. And a couple of times he emphasized that it is important to give the president credit. He's not a president that Mike Lee is particularly fond of historically. Give him credit for at least not launching any new wars, which hasn't happened for at least four presidencies or thereabouts out there, which is not all, you know, a blank check, a high five for Trump's foreign policy. And it is interesting, as Suderman points out, that Trump has been saying since 2012, at least, that what the hell are we doing in Afghanistan? And it's frustrating. And it's also kind of a mark of the difficulty of, you know, the awful responsibility of governance, that these clearly stated goals still can't so far be met. But perhaps these negotiations are pointing in that direction. I want to pivot hard, scratch the needle across the record, because this is also back to school week. Is everyone's kids going back to school? Peter, your kids going back to school this week?
My dog is going to be going for longer walks because of the fall weather.
Very good. But it's back to school week for millions and millions of people. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of school-related news out there, and I just wanted to bounce each of us to talk about something off the top of their heads. Nick, you and I think both listened to the same WNYC report this morning here, Commie Radio in New York, which is nonetheless very interesting. And
In New York, we just call it radio.
Yeah, that's true. That's talking about the post-Katrina charter school overhaul in New Orleans. What interested you about that? Or you can talk about anything else you want to.
It was that for the first time this fall, every person attending a public school in New Orleans is in a charter school. It's 100% school district. It had been very close to that for a while. But it was a report that was originally sourced out of a New Orleans-based public radio station that, however you slice it, charter schools end up doing better. One of the attacks on charter schools is that they are disruptive in that when charter schools are bad, they get shut down, and then that strands students. Either sometimes they get shut down in the middle of a year, an academic year, if they're particularly bad, or at the end of an academic year, and then students have to scramble, and it's very disruptive for parents and students alike, which makes total sense. But that particular segment looked at research done by a Tulane researcher named Douglas Harris, and he found that even when you factor in that disruption effect, that sometimes the students who go to charter schools that get shut down because they're performing poorly, there is a short-term dip in their test scores and their academic performance. But by 2 years later, they are actually doing better than students, comparable students who had stayed in F-rated schools that just suck and continue to stay open. So it's, more powerful evidence that charter schools, actually help the people that are, they're designed to help, which are students. It's not designed to help teachers or parents or sports teams or anything like that. The idea of schools are that they educate, students K through 12. K through 12 students do better when they are offered the option of charter schools, which is a form of school choice that is, for a variety of reasons, seems to be the most politically viable form of school choice. And it's a good thing. And then in that segment, and you hear this echo throughout, and I know Catherine's going to talk a little bit about it on the Democratic presidential stage, you hear people going after charter schools for saying, it's very disruptive to have a shitty school get shut down and then a new school has to come about. It's like, yeah, it is disruptive, and it's better than the alternative, which is just that you stay in a terrible school for your entire education.
I was struck listening to that this morning by they gave a lot of space to critics of this change. And one of what the basis of their criticism was that it creates uncertainty. If your neighborhood school gets shuttered because it's no good and is replaced by a charter school, it's difficult to make plans and all this kind of stuff. I'm struck by that because, as I've written about on our site, and hopefully one day in the magazine, there are New York City, where my kids go to public school, is undergoing massive amounts of completely unsettling, unpredictable change. Just last week, a handpicked mayoral commission called the School Diversity Advisory Group. So Bill de Blasio appointed them to, in their words and in the words of everybody as they describe things here, which is frustrating to me, in the words of desegregation, using that as the exact same word as was used in the 1950s, they are going to make the following recommendations that de Blasio now has to figure out if he wants to enact. The ones that got the headlines were, we're going to get rid of the gifted and talented programs and actually even the nomenclature. We're not going to use the words gifted and talented anymore because it makes people sad and gives a sense that, some groups are better than others. The gifted and talented programs are disproportionately used or adopted by or benefited from Asian American students and also white students compared to blacks and Latinos. So they were going to do that. And they're also they recommended removing all kind of what they call here screens, or basically selections criteria among schools. So like before, and still in many districts, a school can say, hey, look, if you were late 5 times last year and missed more than 5 days of school, maybe we don't want you because you're going to be disruptive. Stop that, because that affects people disproportionately. Those are the headline things. But as I pointed out, and Carol Markowitz did in a pretty good piece in the New York Post today, the overall wrap of this is actually far more radical and far more disruptive than the parents complaining in the New Orleans piece this morning, which is to say they want, within 3 years, every single school in a district to have the exact same demographic proportions as each other, as the district as a whole. Within 5 years, they want every school to have the exact same demographic proportions as the borough of New York, so Brooklyn, whatever. And in 10 years, every school has the exact same demographic composition as the entire city of New York. Imagine the crazy logistical disruptions and the difficulty in planning ahead for anybody that all would cause, which underlined particularly Carol Markowitz's story. It's amazing to me that people are basically, as we've talked about a month or two ago, kind of reliving through the history of busing in the 1970s. Like, we've got to get the proportions right, and there's going to be a lot of hard lessons to be relearned, apparently. Catherine, what is jumping out at you as a back-to-school mother this week?
As the mother of children. No, I mean, we've talked before about my deep, deep well of rage at Bernie Sanders for his scapegoating of private for-profit charter schools that are ruining America. You know, that's, I think, you know, many of Nick's criticisms have already kind of touched on this. You know, the notion that people might want different things for their kids, that we might not want all schools to be exactly the same cookie cutter replicas of each other and of your borough and of the city of New York. You know, this is, you know, not to put on my full Gillespie here, but like, we have so many choices. We have all the different flavors of Pop-Tarts. Why can't we have different flavors of school?
Always go full Gillespie.
Always go full Gillespie. Don't,
Pop-Tarts.
Y'all. Yeah. But you know, the notion that someone somewhere making money in the system is the reason schools are bad just strikes me as so absurd on its face as to be infuriating. But actually, Matt, as you were talking, like, my real back to school takeaway is, despite the fact that DC has a huge number of charters, that it's a very, very charter friendly system, I find myself grappling with the uncertainty problem that you just described, that there's a high, high cost to not being able to think ahead and plan, particularly if you are like an absolutely garbage type A overachiever firstborn like me, and you want to have your whole life planned out and your whole children's lives planned out forever and ever. Amen. Charters don't solve that problem. And like, no disrespect to my Uncle Milton, who, you know, had a lot of important thoughts about how to promote school choice. Vouchers are actually, you know, more and more, I find myself coming back to this idea that when there was a sort of branch in the road and we chose to take the charter school branch, we did a lot of good for a lot of kids. Advocating charters was an absolutely valuable thing to do, but it's not a fix for everyone, and it's not a fix for my family. I mean, my kids are in public school right now. I don't think anyone owes them an education. I, you know, can ish-ish sort of afford to pay for them out of my own pocket to go other places. And yet none of the options seem good to me. And it's because the market for schools is still so constricted by the dominance of the public system, in the same way that health insurance is very, very broken, in part because Medicare and Medicaid are so dominant in the system. Education is broken because public schools are so dominant in the system, and they set the tone and the template for what's out there. There are not really weird, innovative schools flourishing everywhere in a time when there are really weird, innovative, everything else flourishing everywhere. And I wish that weren't the case.
Yeah, to follow up, about 91% of K-12 students go to public schools.
Catherine, I want to just commend you for that attempted lateral to Suderman there with the Medicare and Medicaid angle.
I was trying. What are your back-to-school thoughts about health insurance policy, Peter?
I guess I would just reflect what you said in certain ways, because I have heard this from so many parents. I'm in my late 30s. I know a lot of folks who have relatively young kids and are thinking, they have kids in the, you know, in the 2 to 9 range, but often just kids, you know, just kids under 5. And they are now trying, and in many cases failing, to be able to plan not only which school they want to send their kids to, but where, what houses they're going to buy, in what neighborhoods. There are just very clear markups in Washington, D.C. based on certain blocks and certain neighborhoods because they feed into certain schools, especially when you get to high school. It radically increases the cost of housing. And really changes the market in certain ways. Now, this is not true necessarily everywhere in the United States. And in fact, some of the people you can really overstate, as people like, for example, Elizabeth Warren have done in terms of how much the kind of the chase for housing, the chase for good schools has inflated housing prices across the country. But in certain parts of Washington, D.C. and New York and L.A. and San Francisco, very high cost cities, it's just exceptionally expensive to buy your way into a decent public school, because it adds a huge, huge amount to houses that are already extremely expensive.
We, just to build on that example, we moved to New York. This is one of the three main reasons, because we lived in D.C. And at that time, D.C. Elementary schools, public elementary schools, not so good in the places that we wanted to live. And so when we moved to New York, we chose an elementary school district that had, and they're zoned here based on residential maps. So we chose one that had immersion French. So my daughters can learn the grammar of French in addition to speaking it at home with their mom. And so we moved into a very small neighborhood that is incredibly expensive, because this is a very well-functioning and well-known school. Right now, that same elementary school district is thinking about getting rid of residential zoning altogether and having a lottery system and an algorithm to even out the demographics. And I've been going to all these meetings, sadly. And so we live I could throw a softball even with my ancient shoulders, and it could hit the school from where I'm at. Chances are very strong, even if they just rezone a little bit, which they might also do, that I'll be zoned out of the place that we moved here for. And when I went to a recent meeting, the district superintendent said, you know, we have a lot of really segregated schools here, a lot of white, rich white people, you know, live in these neighborhoods, very particular to the neighborhood. And, you know, I, this is her speaking, not Matt, frankly, I can't even afford to live in some of these neighborhoods. And man, she makes $192,000 a year. Screw you. Screw you.
I mean, we're highlighting here over and over the fact that everything else that we consume, and despite all of the high-flown rhetoric around it, like education, especially education for very, very young children, is a consumption good, right? Like, much of what I am consuming is just like, they got to go somewhere during the day. And I would love it if the place they went, A, kind of didn't suck, and B, was kind of convenient to my house. Like, my standards are not high for this. And yet, you know,
You want it to be safe. I mean, that's the main thing.
That kind of not suck was, I think, it has be safe embedded in it.
This drives even at the sort of mid-level, right? There's a class of parents who are like, well, my kids have to have, you know, the very tip-top educational outcomes, right? Oh, only the school with the highest acceptance to Yale, right, Catherine? But actually, it's a lot about parents being worried about their kids
right.
being
and this is why this is a big case for charters that I think is always undervalued when people talk about charters, is that, okay, you're looking at the test scores, you know, it's kids who go to charters often do better, but not always. But one thing that you really consistently see is that parents who took their kids out of extremely dysfunctional public schools did so because they just wanted their children's physical safety to be assured, and the charters can often offer that in places where the traditional public schools cannot. So I think, you know, that's absolutely right. But the fact that there is political risk to ordinary civilians, both in terms of their financial safety because they buy a house that gets zoned out of a good school district and drops in value or whatever, the fact that they feel compelled to buy a house at all, which I am team rent forever, and this kind of conversation always makes me even more on team rent forever, like, individual citizens
You're
should
baiting
not,
me.
Individual citizens should not be at the whim of some bureaucrat somewhere for something as basic and personal and fundamental as where their kids go to school. And they are. Everyone in America is. 91% of American kids are every day.
Amen, and Catherine Mangu Ward. Don't you talk about housing. Go, Peter.
I'm not going to talk about, about housing a little, but what I was going to know is the thing that I would just add more generally here is that the attempt to kind of provide a universal good where you don't have any choice, local schools for everyone where you're just assigned based on your address, And you get that your kid is maybe entitled to go to that school. If you live on the boundary, perhaps you become entitled to go to a different school at some point, right? And so they shift you around, and there's all of that. It is an attempt to sort of provide an egalitarian benefit to everyone. But what ends up happening? What ends up happening is that the market just shifts to the housing market itself. And that if Bernie Sanders is concerned about profits here, the kind of old line public school teacher liberal model of public education just ends up putting profits in the hands of homeowners.
Boo.
Right? And it just ends up shifting, right? Like you create effectively a kind of black market pricing for schools that is done entirely through the housing market. Again, this is not.
There's also, by the way,
this is much less
market
of a concern outside of a relatively small number of very high cost, but also high productivity
cities. It's throughout. It's, more Americans live in suburbs than in small towns or in large cities. And suburbs are explicit about the class dimension, I think. And that's, it's cause for concern if you care about things like economic mobility and educational opportunity. It's deeply disturbing that certain towns price people out through manipulating real estate prices, as well as doing things like zoning where yards have to be a certain size. You can't have more than one kitchen in a house. Every building has to be a single family dwelling. And that builds into the schools. I mean, this is as somebody who grew up in the New York metro area and has lived in, every part of the country. I've seen this time and time again, and it's disturbing. And this is delinking just as delinking, I think, healthcare from employment would be radical and transformative. I think delinking education from residential real estate prices or real estate would be massively transformational in all sorts of ways that would disrupt a lot of people and disrupt a lot of class hierarchy and really unleash an enormous amount of productive energy in America.
In addition to the housing black market, there's also an explicit bribery incentive for people who live on the edges of school districts, because there has to be discretion in the system somewhere. Right. In D.C., for example, there was a massive scandal. People who don't even live in the District of Columbia, people who are not D.C. taxpayers, attending D.C. public schools by bribing admissions officials in those schools to look the other way about their official residency.
It's almost as if one size fits all bureaucratic systems breed corruption. Yep.
I was going to say there are markets in everything, and some of those markets could be better brought into the sunlight, but same.
I should point out that the dominant trend, New York is kind of leading this in the name of equity and desegregation, is actually to do away with residential zones. So, Nick, you should be happy, except that it is this great euphemism called controlled choice, meaning you choose.
Jesus, is that what it's really called?
Yes, yeah, sure is. So if this
it's a variation on open enrollment. So as long as
mandatory.
You're within the city, you have access to all of the schools that are there. It's not.
I want mandatory buyback on the controlled choice.
There is. So what they do in our local middle school district, and what one of the proposals for doing with our elementary school sub-district is, you as a parent, you list your preferences. It would be 7 elementary schools, and in middle schools, it's 11 or 12. And then there's a lottery number, there's an algorithm, there's some race and socioeconomics. Actually, it's all socioeconomics, but that's perceived to bleed over into producing different racial outcomes. And then they spit out a designation. They control your choice. You rank your preferences and you pray. That is the way that people propose to get rid of the patterns of a privilege that accrue to, bad people like me.
I bet the system will be incorruptible, and definitely no one will end up getting favorable treatment in that lottery system, right, Matt?
Holy crap.
In New York, a city famed for its transparent incorruptibility.
Let's go to our, speaking of corruptions, let's go to our end of show. What have you been corrupting yourself with culturally? Suderman, would you like to launch?
So I'm going to take. I've got two this week, but they'll be short. I've been listening to the new Lana Del Rey album, Norman Fucking Rockwell, with an exclamation point. It's a masterpiece. Like, it's just one of these. It's a great, like, immediately perfect pop album that kind of captures. It's Joni Mitchell meets Instagram ennui, and I love it. And if that, like, if you want something that just like feels your late summer vibe and like all the things that you're just like, ah, oh, that's
what is life the is like. Controlling so, metaphor? Does I mean, what's it have to do with Norman Rockwell?
I don't think it has any. I don't know that it has anything directly to do with Norman Rockwell. What it has to do is with the sort of picture perfectness or lack thereof of American life. Anyway, she's great. This is, I think, her best album, and it is especially coming right after the new Taylor Swift album. There's a clear winner here in terms of like who should be like at the top of the pop world right now. And the other thing that I saw is the 20th anniversary re-release of The Matrix, which is now playing in theaters. It came out 20 years ago this spring, and it's been re-released in Dolby Vision and, even more important, Dolby Atmos surround. So old surround sound systems only used a couple of channels that surrounded you basically at ear level. And this, the new surround sound system, is smarter and more complex. It's object oriented. So it just sort of, a computer says, here, put the sound kind of wherever it wants you to, where it sort of, it tells the computer where to put the sound in the theater, and it's also it's a full hemisphere of sound, so it sort of it envelops you in Neo's fights with Agent Smith. The movie holds up; it's fantastic. Highly recommend seeing it in the theater again if you can.
From the best year of our Lord in cinematic history, as far as I'm concerned. Nick, to partially answer the question that Suderman dodged, from what I've read about Lana Del Rey and the Norman fucking Rockwell, it is sort of a picture snapshot of America in decline, yet we're all still here. Nick, you go forth.
Oh, and she, I just want to point out, she went to the very elite Kent School in New England, which currently costs $48,000 a year for day students. So she
seemed to work
has
out.
Her thumb on the pulse of middle America and declining America pretty well. I spent a good chunk of yesterday watching the British TV series Crashing by Phoebe Waller-Bridge from 2016. She's better known probably in the U.S. for Fleabag, as well as her work on the Han Solo movie or the Star Wars stuff. And she's writing
and
the next
Killing
James
Eve.
Bond movie. Yeah, and Killing Eve as well, which I guess is currently in production, right? But Crashing is about a bunch of 20-something kind of layabouts making their way in Little Britain. And it's very funny, very dark. And like, if you liked Fleabag, you should definitely check this out.
Catherine, what are you consuming?
First of all, I am just super here for the Phoebe Waller-Bridge moment that we are having. I am 100%
into it. That's a good one. I hope it lasts for 100 years.
So the fun thing that I watched this weekend was the Dark Crystal reboot thingy.
Did you get through all of it?
No, I didn't. But I watched a lot of it, and it's delightful. I have no deep analysis to share on it. And so instead, I want to tell you about the thing that I was really reading this week, which was a book published in 1920 called Plastic Surgery of the Face by H.D. Giles. You guys, I don't know. I fell down an internet rabbit hole, and I make no apologies for the fact that I read every single page of this illustrated book showing just over and over and over people whose faces were utterly destroyed by World War I being reconstructed. Basically, it's a photo series of one individual and his team inventing modern plastic surgery as we know it. It is disgusting. Like, I just want to be clear. If you have any squeamishness, do not even think about taking out my recommendation. But if you're the kind of person that, like, sometimes watches, like, gross videos of medical things on YouTube, you should absolutely check out this book. It is honestly, like, just a miracle of human ingenuity. Among other things, I will just briefly describe how they figured out how to stave off infection from skin grafts, which is to leave the skin attached to wherever it is being grafted from, stretch it to the new place where it's going to go, sew it on, wait for it to take, then snip it off and put the tube of extra skin back.
It's I really feel like I've seen
amazing.
That in a horror movie on like Showtime at 3 a.m.
Yes.
I think I saw that at Penn Station.
You can get this book at archive.org. It's out of copyright. It's free and available. And it is just like, oh my God, humans.
So it's in
like
the public domain.
Work. Yeah,
we
I think
so. Let's make a sitcom based on it. Yeah. Or I guess the yes. Nick already has done that.
Humans destroyed each other's faces by inventing total war and then invented plastic surgery to fix them. And overall, I'm still pro-humans.
Catherine. You could make it about a bunch of really shallow doctors who like don't have much in the way of personality, and you could call it Skin Deep.
Stop.
Oh, very nice.
Yeah. The surgery isn't just Skin Deep. They're like building new teeth and jaws and stuff. It's amazing.
We're good.
I do recommend the documentary from a couple of years ago called Take My Nose, Please, by Joan Crone, a legendary journalist and first-time documentarian at age 90. Which is all about a history of plastic surgery. A wonderful, wonderful and uplifting story.
Oh, yeah. And closing note on this book, this same doctor also performed the first or one of the very, very first sex change operations using the same techniques.
Catherine, over the weekend, my eldest daughter asked me, am I lucky to have been born in 2008? Which is an interesting question. And I said, yes, in general, the present is always better than the past, particularly compared to 1918. And then now that you've just told me that we can find this easily accessible public domain stuff from 1920, I'm going to reconsider my answer to her. What I watched over the last week, twice even, was Dave Chappelle's latest Netflix stand-up, Sticks and Stones, which is super great. A couple parts are not as funny as other parts, for sure. And it's a very interesting document. And it's all right there, right in your face about the stuff that we're not supposed to be able to talk about and the cancel culture and all of this. He manages to transcend just being a reactionary about all of that. That's always the slippery slope. It's the danger of constantly a lot of comics are doing right now, Ricky Gervais and other people, like every single one of their things is about how the audience is terrible. Yet it's still great, and it wrong foots you, and he goes places that you shouldn't go, and you laugh a lot. And it's very interesting to see also the kind of, I think, mostly dumb meta media reaction to it from certain quarters, like, oh, he's now punching down. Like, yeah, what? So, like, that whole crackhead thing that he did with the Chappelle Show, was that punching up? But anyways, it's...
Yeah, you know, he was taking on Rick James. Rick James, who was, like, you know, the leader of the Elders of Zion, back in the day.
But anyways, really great. He remains, just a foundational a slice of our cultural moment, and he's just tremendously talented and interesting.
Do you want to put frosting on that foundational slice, Matt?
That's not a bad idea. It's getting into the fall.
I agree that he is...
Not like pepperoni and mushrooms?
Yeah, and maybe some pineapple. He is not simply a really great comic. I think he's like, you know, if not the best, one of the very best social commentators right now. You know, really, really fascinating and forcing everybody to kind of, you know, check your premises. I look forward to his next special.
Very good. All right. Well, that's all the time that we have this week. Thank you for listening. I hope this week is better than every week for all of you. And please leave comments wherever you see this, whether it's on the Reason site or just in the ether. Thank you and good night.